1:30 p.m. on February 16th, 2018. We're meeting today in room 205 in the Capitol Building. Please remember to silence your cell phone as a courtesy. Committee members present today are Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Giesel, Senator Begich, and myself, Senator Wilson. This afternoon will be a brief, to you for the Medicaid services waivers. We'd like to welcome our presenters today, Dwayne Mays, the Director of Division for Senior and Disability Services, and also in the audience, John Sherwood is here available for questions, and Deb as the Deputy Commissioner for the Department, and Deputy Director of the Division, Deb Etheridge, is also here in the audience for questions. Please feel free to come up, Dwayne and Director Sherwood, Deputy Commissioner Sherwood, and please remember to state your name for the record, and you may begin when ready.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is John Sherwood. I'm Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Health and Social Services.
Mr. Chair, my name is Dwayne Mays. I'm the Director for the Division of Senior and Disability Services. So today's presentation is going to be on waiver optional services, and we're going to kind of walk you through that. We'll talk to you about the federal law, and that'll be the first piece of this presentation. And then we'll kind of evolve to where we are today with these optional services. And so that'll be the gist of our presentation. So I'm going to manage this. So the first piece is just the federal law. They're very broad in terms of requirements. States have the ability to make operational policy decisions when it comes to waivers. The key issue to remember is that with these optional services, we have the right to identify who is eligible for enrollment. So think about that. What services? We can identify the array of services in terms of what we believe is necessary. What services are covered? How payments are set? So those are the three pieces that are important when it comes to the operational and policy decisions that we can make as a state when it comes to optional services. The state must comply with federal requirements. States can seek additional flexibility in applying for formal waivers with approval from the Secretary of Health and Human Services. So we have that. So federal law. So Medicaid can be classified either as a demonstration waiver or a program waiver. So there's a difference, demonstration and program. Demonstration waivers can allow the state the ability to test new or existing approaches around financing, and delivery. An example of that would be what we're doing within the state right now under Senate Bill 74. It's the 1115 demonstration waiver. Up to 5 years in terms of, if you get approval, 5 years for that demonstration with the possibility you can extend up to 3 more years, 1 year at a time. So the key to remember is testing new and existing approaches to service delivery. Program waivers is different in that they have been designed to expand the array of defined program options available to the state. So program waivers is not an avenue for experimentation. So the 1915C that we will spend the majority of our presentation talking about, that's a program waiver.
Just a quick question here. Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So the to the previous slide there, demonstration waivers allow a state to test new or existing approaches. As part of these waivers, if you're testing new approaches, you, I would think, want to know whether that approach works or not. So generally, is there an accompanying data collection requirement and reporting requirement for each of these waivers? And do you, I mean, you, I see that you nod your head, but when we've asked for these before, because I see a page later on where you list a lot of the waivers, where can I find all that data collection and analysis and showing what works and what doesn't?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, the 1115 demonstration waivers do require that level of evaluation, and there it is part of the waiver application how you are going to monitor and how you are going to evaluate what hypotheses you are testing as part of the waiver. Alaska, to my knowledge, has only operated one 1115 demonstration waiver several years ago, very small, around requiring children on the portion of the Medicaid that's paid for through the CHIP program to subjecting them to a period of ineligibility if their parents dropped health insurance. I think that waiver operated for just the five original years. Our evaluation did not substantiate that it had the effects we were expecting, and we dropped that. I think we could go back and provide that information. The waivers we're going to be talking about today, the 1915C waivers, are subject to reporting requirements around our expenditures and around our quality assurance, and we can provide you with those reports that we need to submit for those. I know the financial reports, the CMS 372s, are posted on the federal websites. We can provide the reports that we give to CMS around quality for our waivers if the committee would like.
Thank you. Yes, before a quick follow-up, Senator Von Imhoff, just remember to state your name for the record, as folks at home are going back and forth and may not be able to distinguish between your voices.
Thank you. For the record, that was John Sherwood answering the last question.
Thank you. So I do appreciate the offer of the expenditure reporting and the quality assurance reporting. I guess that I am more interested in is, does the waiver program work? So outcome reporting. You know, we spent this much money, and then this was the decrease of health incidences or the increase of healthy populations. So I think outcome data would be the most interesting thing. So if you have that, absolutely. But I think the other expenditures and quality assurance, I can certainly go find that. Thank you.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, we don't necessarily explicitly report measures of outcome. However, certainly some of our quality measures include outcome measures in terms of the health status of the people receiving the waivers. And again, that was John Sherwood.
Okay. So again, for the record, this is Dwayne Mays, Director for the Division of Senior and Disability Services. So going to slide four, the waivers, and in particular the 1915C, was enacted in 1981 at the federal level. It allows us to waive some of the medical requirements, Medicaid requirements, and it allows us a way to offer home and community-based services to targeted populations, and I think that's important to remember, targeted populations as an alternative to mandatory institutional care.
Just a question. These waivers also allow the cap the numbers of individuals who can receive said services. Does Alaska have any caps on any of the services for individuals?
Mr. Chair, there are four waivers, and a little bit later in the slide deck we'll be breaking that down for you. One of the four waivers, the waiver for those with developmental disabilities, we call that the IDD waiver, individuals with developmental disabilities, we have a cap on that. The other three waivers, we do not.
Okay. Thank you.
So to be eligible, need to meet institutional level care. I would imagine you've heard that time and time again, but you need to meet institutional level care in order to qualify for these waivers. Waiting, going into an institution, rather wanting to be in the community with wraparound supports. Later in the slide deck, there's a slide that goes through all the different kinds of services, but as a snapshot, we just listed a few here. Adult-based services, so if you meet eligibility and you're a senior with dementia, we have 11 adult-based centers in the state. You may be supported by an unpaid family caregiver, but during the course of the day that caregiver has to work, they can bring their mother or father to an adult-based center. And within the center, there's a lot of social engagement and exercises and activities that they can participate in, so adult day. The other piece is chore services, and very self-explanatory, but someone coming into the home, because you can't do that given your disability, to do the upkeep of the home, so chore services. Residential habilitation, so for those with developmental disabilities, maybe in the home, in the residence, learning those IL skills, independent living skills, the ability to do as much as possible on their own, so it's the active teaching that goes on, residential habilitation. Support employment for those with developmental disabilities who are actually working, so they're in a job, in a competitive, integrated job, but they need support. So maybe initially up front, there's going to be quite a bit of support employment, somebody there to support them, to instruct, to help them develop those soft skills, as well as the essential functions of the job. And then over time, those hours will go down. Respite, in terms of providing relief to somebody who is caring, and one of the big issues is burnout when you're doing a lot of caring, so having someone come in. So that's just a snapshot of some of the services that are offered, and we'll get into more of that later on in the slide deck. So this is the continuum of care slide, and about 5 years ago, I was in front of the House Finance Subcommittee for Health and Social Services, and they confirmed that they liked this slide because it's very consolidated. There's a lot of good information here. And so from then to now, we have done this every year, and we always make this a part of our presentation. So for just perspective of what this looks like, when you look to the left side of this continuum of care, it's the community-based grants. It's the lower end of care. When you look to the right side, at the far right, is our facility care. It's nursing home care and so forth. High-end costs, low-end costs. So within the...
Senator DeVondemo.
Thank you. So through the chair, if you've been doing this for a few years, then do you have, then let's say 2015, the slide from 2016, so we can compare how the slide to 2017 is working, so we can see the change of... the number of patients served, the cost per patient, et cetera, and just, you know, look for trends. So if you have, if you've been doing this for a few years, then hopefully those slides will be easy to get. 16, 17?
Through the chair, Representative or Senator Von Inhofe, absolutely can do that. I have a folder with all of those continuum of care slides, and I'll just very briefly, when you look at this continuum of care, we've been able to realize some reductions through utilization control, the rewrite of the regulations. I refer to it as the right sizing. So when you look across this continuum of care, you're going to see that. And if you go back to 2015, you will see the difference between what we expended then to what we are expending now. So specific to this presentation, it's really the four waivers. So it's the, if you go down to the bottom and you look at the horizontal line, it says home and community-based services. Then you have four vertical columns. The column to the left is our Alaskans living independently, and would be those individuals that are seniors primarily and those with physical disabilities. So that's who we serve within that column, and it's targeted to that population. $72 million expended in this particular waiver in FY17. We served 1,933 people in FY17. The average amount per person per year is $37,000. So as a point of reference, you can look to the right and see that if they were in a nursing home, your cost would be $164,000 a year. The column to the right of that is our children with complex medical conditions. It's a relatively small waiver, 222 children between the ages of 0 and 21 that we serve. They have very complicated medical conditions. So we spend about $10.7 million on that waiver. The average amount per person per year is around $48,000. The third column to the right is our IDD waiver, those with developmental disabilities. You'll see that we expended in FY17 $186 million. We served 2,085. And just another note, I didn't mention the other two columns. It's a match, 50-50 match. And the average amount is about $89,000 per year for those individuals. And then the last column is a very small waiver of 88 individuals with physical and developmental disabilities. Again, it's a dollar-for-dollar match with the federal government, and it's about $96,000 a year. Overall, $8.5 million we expended for that. So in its entirety, if you look up at the top column for home and community-based services waivers in FY17, we spent $278
million. Senator Von Imhoff.
So I do like the slide. Thank you, because it does provide a snapshot. So one of the things that we've heard with previous HESS presentations is the issue of maintenance of effort. So when a particular program is established, and I definitely would like to break out, you know, our traditional programs versus then the waiver programs, once they've established and kind of picked up speed, there's a level of maintenance of effort, and that maintenance of effort seems to go up each year as new people are added, and the new threshold seems to be reset each year, and so the bar keeps on going up and up and up and up, and there is no way to dip below it. Can you comment on how to manage maintenance of effort, first of all, with our traditional programs, how to manage maintenance of effort and whether it applies to the waiver programs, and how do we manage that?
And before you do, I just want to welcome Senator Machicki to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you again. For the record, this is John Sherwood, through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff. Well, first, there is not an explicit maintenance of effort requirement with the home and community-based waivers. They are operated at the decision of states. Now, that said, every state has these waivers at this point. They are seen as a cost-effective alternative. We have not encountered problems limiting our number of people served in the waiver for the IID population. Individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities. That said, a little later in the presentation, we're going to talk about a separate law, case law around the Americans with Disability Act, often referred to as the Olmstead decision, which does constrain states' abilities to remove these waivers or any kind of services once in place for individuals with disabilities. And we'll get to that a little bit later. Overall, the maintenance of effort in the Medicaid program, the most significant maintenance of effort other than agreements to provide services to certain mandatory populations and provide mandatory services as part of the Medicaid program, is the maintenance of effort around children. And as a result of the Affordable Care Act and extended through several reauthorizations of the CHIP program, states operating CHIP programs have to they have to maintain the level of eligibility for children on Medicaid through age 18. I think one of the last bills they passed pushed that out to about 2027, but we'll get the exact date for you. I know they went out to 2023 when they reauthorized CHIP, and I think there may have been one more since then. There's also maintenance of effort related to Medicaid in our Adult Public Assistance Program, which is our state supplement to SSI. And it requires us to either maintain payment levels that were in place in the 80s or to spend as much money as we did in the prior year on our state supplement or our APA program. But the penalty for not meeting that requirement is loss of all federal funding for the Medicaid program. So that's the other major maintenance of effort requirement that's imposed on Medicaid. In terms of managing that, we try and stay cognizant of what our obligations are, but Generally speaking, those are provisions that are in federal law, and if we're going to operate a Medicaid program, we're going to need to meet those provisions.
Follow up, Senator Von Den Bom.
Thank you. So I had a constituent a while back say something to me that I'd like to get whether it's true or false, because I actually don't know if what this person said was true. What this person said was, we can address maintenance of effort by resetting the eligibility from requirements or resetting to be more of federally average requirements they have in the other lower 48 states for new patients coming in, keeping the same level of payments and eligibility for previous patients or patients already in the system. But you draw a line, let's say 2020, we pick a year. So from here on out, any new patients are in these new requirements and these new services, keeping in mind that we will honor our previous patients in the exact same levels before from here on out. So we'll kind of have almost two groups of patients receiving services, one that eventually phases out over time, and then the new group. And so this person basically told me that's how you reset the maintenance of effort for, and it takes a period of time, maybe a generation, but that's how you do it. Is that true?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, again, this is John Sherwood. I don't know of a provision that works exactly like that. There are some mandatory levels that we must meet that are tied to point in time. Others of them are tied to, say, the federal poverty level, which you couldn't reset. But for example, if we chose to some of our eligibility standards increase annually with changes in the CPI, there are some categories where we could choose to not increase those limits at that level. At one time, before there was a maintenance of effort around CHIP, the legislature chose to reduce the eligibility levels for children and pregnant women and freeze them at the 2003 standards. We could do something similar, I believe, for pregnant women, but not for children under the current maintenance of effort requirement. So there are some options to do something like that. I think in terms of a specific scenario, it would be good to have a little more detail if there's a particular area folks are thinking of, because there's different categories of eligibility. Some are tied to federal standards, which change every year, and some are essentially the state establishes those standards and they may not be subject to change, but we kind of would have to go through approximately 30 categories of eligibility and kind of look at where those options are.
Senator Machicki.
So I at some point we have to work together on containing the cost of Medicaid. I think we all agree with that, right? I mean, we have to understand what escalation looks like. I know you have a new tool, but some of us that are focused on, and I guess the way I explained this earlier today is, and I'll say it every time I meet with you all, I can't stress enough how important it is what you do for a living, and I appreciate it. I know that you care about Alaskans that have the greatest needs. But at some point, we have to think about that. Could you get us a list of the 30 categories? Is that what you said? Sorry.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, again, this is John Sherwood. Yeah, it's approximately 30 categories of eligibility, 30 different. Some of them aren't very different from one another. We're required by federal law to distinguish, but we can provide a list of all the categories we cover.
It'd be very helpful, Mr. Chairman, if I can follow up just a bit.
Yes, guys.
In the subcommittee process, I think it's something that we have to evaluate. in most categories being, well, just to say the average is around 200% of the federal poverty level, I believe, just from a first look at those categories. Is that an effective method of managing cost? I mean, do you if you were to remove, and I know you're going to not like this suggestion, but does removing the top 10% from those categories have a material effect on cost? You're saying something in the 200% range becomes 190% of the federal poverty line level. What does that effect look like? I mean, you're still protecting the most vulnerable Alaskans. Perhaps we have a transition period for those that are currently covered that perhaps wouldn't be covered, or we have a in that transition, sort of what you talked about, perhaps you freeze today's and you have a transition for later. Is that something you've evaluated, or is that something your department just kind of sits back and says, well, legislate, that's your job, legislature. You have that discussion on your own, and if you decide to move that kind of legislation, we'll deal with it, or do you have an opinion?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, have we at different times looked at the impacts of reducing our eligibility standards? Yes, we have. It's and as I mentioned, we did it once beginning in 2003. Eventually, we increased them, not all the way back to the original point, but about halfway. I want to say about 2008-2009. I think if you reduce the standard, some people will become ineligible and you will save some money. I think one of the things that's important to realize is that to the extent that the people with the greatest need have the ability to control their income, they will take the efforts they need to take to maintain their coverage if that's the only option they have to get coverage. So typically we would not say expect a cut that resulted in the in say a 10% reduction in eligibility to provide us with a 10% reduction in spending, and part of that is also just related to health status. Typically people with worse health status don't make as much money. It interferes with their ability to get income, so we would expect there to be something like, you know, a relationship that's not a one-to-one relationship, but I would acknowledge that if we did find a way to reduce the eligibility, that would have some impact on our spending. And of course, I think virtually all of those are legislative actions that would be required to take to reduce eligibility.
A follow-up, Senator?
Yeah, I mean, that's the definition of a broken system, right, where folks will kind of push themselves to earn less so that they remain qualified. That means our system is not working, and we have to look at other avenues, and that's a very comprehensive solution that we're not talking about today. You, of course, could control some of that by hand-picking the eligibility categories, so that those that are most in need health-wise don't have the same change as healthier adults. I don't know. I think it's something that we have to look at. I think it's something, you know, we've reduced cost in every other area. One of them we haven't considered is Medicaid eligibility, and I openly admit that your department has taken... You've worked with us for substantial cuts in the last 6 years, 5 years. It's hard to get to an answer without at least considering the level of eligibility, I think.
I can build a point. I think I have an idea what you're asking for.
Take a brief at ease here. Back on the record.
Again,
Senator Baggage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a question for context.
Does the division have a mission statement? And if so, would you mind reading it? For my context, I...
And as...
So for the record, again, this is Dwayne Mays, Director for the Division of Senior Disability Services. Whenever I talk to my friends about what I do, I lose them within 5 minutes. So I just tell them, because it's very complicated, that we're the long-term support services division supporting our vulnerable populations, people with disabilities, and our senior population. We consolidate our mission. That's why you caught me off guard, because we have a pretty comprehensive vision statement, but for the purposes of making it very user-friendly for the legislature, the vision statement is to promote the independence of Alaskan seniors and persons with physical and developmental disabilities. That's our vision statement. So supporting them in their communities, community-based settings, is our primary focus. Thank you very
much. Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Majicki.
Before we move on, we're talking about, I just want to make it clear for anyone that may be listening, because we can all be misunderstood at times. My goal is so that we have adequate funding without a revolution for those most vulnerable populations that perhaps at some point we evaluate the needs of perhaps the least needy served by Department of Health and Social Services. That I just wanted to clarify that. I mean, I think everyone knows where I stand on senior and care for those with disabilities, right? We're going to continue to fight for those programs. I believe that is the role of government for folks that have difficult time providing for themselves because of either disabilities or extreme adverse financial issues related to those problem. So I think everyone knows that. Sometimes it's worth saying it on the record. So that's enough. I'll just sit and listen. But in case folks don't know, as we go through the subcommittee process, that's always going to be our focus.
Thank you. Please continue.
Again, for the record, Dwayne Mays with Senior Disability Services. Before I go to the next slide, just a couple sound bites. I've been at this for, it'll be my eighth year in December, and I do believe that we, as a division, have been very accountable in making sure that every penny is accounted for. If you were to look back at the other continuum of care slides, you're going to see some of that. And so being able to kind of slow down that growth. In the very beginning, when I came onto the division, we were growing at about $40 to $60 million a year. That's not happening today. And so making sure that we have good regulations in place, we have a very consistent eligibility. Whether you think this is a good thing or a bad thing, it's one of the strictest eligibilities in the country. So it's been very consistent for us. Our advocacy organizations may not like it, but that's what we've had from the beginning of my time with the division. So I feel as though we collectively, our staff, have worked very hard to make sure that every penny is accounted for, and we can provide you with that evidence. So, history of the waiver.
Mr. Chairman, before we move on, I do have a question on the last slide, and it's much more directly related to this discussion.
All right. That?
Last. Yes, back, please. The chart. Yes. I am assuming, considering the percentage of federal support on the grant programs versus the 50-50 support of the waiver programs, that we have maximized all of the grant or evaluated all of the grant programs for the potential of a 50-50 waiver program.
So for the record, again, Dwayne Mays with Senior Disability Services. First, let me just state, we've been flat funded for several years now with our grants. And then the statement I made before, it's a low-cost solution to supporting seniors and people with disabilities in the community. We have made, and later on in this slide deck, I'm going to talk about our success, and we will go live in May with this, of taking a general fund component referred to as Community and Developmental Disability Grants, $11.6 million of GF dollars under Senate Bill 74, and moving that over to a Medicaid authority, putting a cap on it, and then creating a wait list so we can manage its growth. So we're taking that general fund program, we're moving into the Medicaid authority. Half of that will go away, so that's the reduction, replaced by the 1915C individualized supports waiver. So we'll talk more about that. So we have been, you know, as we look at all of these things, we're thinking, what can we do to move some of these general fund grant components over into a Medicaid authority?
Thank you.
Thank you. Please continue.
So the history of the waiver in Alaska, the state legislature directed the Department of Health and Social Services to take a look at waiver options to serve Alaskans with disabilities, and this was back in 1990. And that I think that direction was made towards Deputy Commissioner John Sherwood and others to look at that. And then over a period of 3 years, and in 1993, following legislative approval, that's when the department began operating the 1915C home and community based services waiver. We have four, and we'll break that down a little bit later in the slide deck. Just so you know, it's the 25th anniversary, silver anniversary of the home and community based services program. The Commission on Aging last week met and had buttons, and they were celebrating the 25 years. I know the other advocacy groups, when they come to town, will be doing the same thing. So 25 years. So this is the piece that I just mentioned. So in May of 2018, we will add a fifth waiver referred to as the Individualized Supports Waiver, and that's the refinancing of that one GF grant component, 100% general fund program, where we're going to move it into the Medicaid authority, reduce it by half, but we require a match, so 50% of that coming from CMS and 50% from the state. So this is, we have about close to 700 individuals that are currently getting grant dollars, and so we'll move the majority of them over into this new authority. And based on our analysis, and we did a really thorough analysis, 17.5 is generally the amount that those that are on grants are receiving at that level or lower. So we believe that that cap will be manageable. The other piece that's critical is the wait list. And so drawing so many people, as you just mentioned before, Mr. Chairman, do you have a cap? Yes, we do, and that's on the DD waiver. So I think with those two components, we felt safe in making that change. So on this slide, you'll see that of the four, soon to be five waivers, the three that you saw on the continuum of care slide, adults living independently, our senior population, people with physical disabilities, adults with physical and developmental disabilities, and children with complex medical conditions, their requirement when we assess them is, do they meet nursing facility level of care? That's that 24/7 type of care. And if they qualify, they could then enter into a nursing home, but they waive that right to remain within the community with wraparound supports. The bottom two have to do, and the term is a mouthful, intermediate care facilities for individuals with intellectual developmental disabilities, ICF-IDD. And so our DD waiver, the one that you saw in that continuum of care slide, $186 million, that's where that's parked. And the new waiver that I just mentioned, that's where that's parked. So those are the five waivers.
Senator Begich.
Director Mays, within these two categories, the nursing facility level of care and the intermediate care facility, if somebody is denied a waiver, is there an appeal process, and how does that work, if there is such a thing?
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Begich. Senator Begich. Yes, there is. So initial eligibility, if you meet income eligibility through public assistance, and then we will do a functional assessment. We have formalized assessment tools, and then we will do that. If we determine that they meet eligibility, and if they don't agree with that, they can appeal. So the biggest is that we have to reassess every year, make sure that they maintain eligibility for the program. Because some people come in, they may have had a sudden illness or an automobile accident, they meet income eligibility, and they qualify for the waiver. We have to reassess every year. So a year from now, I assess this individual and determine that he does not meet eligibility. Internally, we have a second review. We do that, and if both agree that this person does not meet eligibility, it goes to a third-party contractor. And so at that, if they agree with us, then we've kind of locked that down. So more than likely when they appeal that, with those level of reviews, we're sitting pretty good. So that's the process.
Yes, Senator Begich?
And generally when you have somebody who maybe challenges that review, have you had instances where the review's been reversed? Just curious.
Through the chair, Senator Begich. Yes, a small percent. So what I would say is, so when they appeal, if they can bring forward additional medical documentation to support their position, so if we deny them, we're going to tell them why. And so they know what that is, and then they come back with, and so if they come back with evidence that will that we agree to, we will overturn that decision.
Just a final comment. Yeah.
Go ahead,
Senator Begich.
It sounds like very thorough, and it sounds like a very fair process. Thank you for that presentation.
Thank you.
And on that same line of questioning, because we are dealing with folks that may have intellectual disabilities in terms of the appeal process, are they helped or given the assistance or families given given referrals to help with the sort of appeal process or and also in terms of applying for the waiver services? Or talking with one of my fellow colleagues earlier today that was a mention that brought up some of the constituents' concerns that we may have of making sure people have access to being able to apply for waivers or going through the process.
Mr. Chair, we have two entities within our structure, not within the state, but outside of the state. The Short-Term Assistance Referral Program, STAR, and the Aging and Disability Resource Center. And so for those individuals that are applying for the first time, they would come through. That's our front door. They come through those programs who will assist them to make sure that they have completed an application. They're following all of the steps, and they're a standalone entity. They are not conflicted. They don't belong to an agency that might benefit from that. So they come through that. So for a person with a developmental disability, they may have already contacted a care coordinator because they want to go through the process of applying, and so they have that kind of support.
Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff.
Yes, so for these waiver programs, what is the first, if an individual has two insurance, Medicaid and let's say something else, generally what's the first insurance that pays?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Von Inhofe, this is John Sherwood again. Under federal law, insurance, any kind of private insurance, and almost any other coverage, including say VA coverage, would pay before Medicaid. The one exception is tribal services. But that said, for waivers, most insurance coverage would not include a number of the services that were paid for under a waiver. That would not be part of the coverage package. These are long-term services and supports, and unless an individual has acquired a long-term care insurance plan, much of what would be covered would not be included in your regular medical insurance. There was a little bit of change with the Affordable Care Act requiring insurers to cover some habilitative services, but those benefits are usually fairly limited compared to what individuals on the waivers require.
Okay, so
a follow-up, Senator Von Himmel.
Thank you. So generally, if there is another insurance, that insurance pays first if it's available. However, you said there's an exception is tribal services or tribal insurance, IHS insurance. Is that correct? So IHS insurance is paid second?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, My commissioner would never let me not say that IHS coverage is not insurance. It's not that sort of full set of services. It's available to individuals in specific locations to the extent the resources are there. But under federal law, Medicaid pays before the IHS. The Congress decided several decades ago that the IHS would bill Medicaid for services provided to Medicaid recipients, and that's part of the way the program is funded, with the intention that they bill Medicaid, Medicare, other private insurers first. And so Alaska, like every other state, complies with that.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Again, for the record, Dwayne Mays with Senior and Disability Services. So this is the slide that I mentioned that kind of lays out all the services that can be offered through the waivers. And you heard me describe adult day chore, for example. So this is the menu of services. And just for sake of time, I'm not going to walk through all of this, but just to give you a snapshot of what is that menu of services. So we wanted to share this with you, the Olmstead decision. So in June of 1999, the Supreme Court ruled that unjustified segregation constitutes discrimination and is in violation of the American with Disabilities Act, Title II. This decision was not specific to Medicaid, but it does obligate the state, no matter what type of health care coverage the person may have. This was triggered in the state of Georgia, where there were two women, Lois Curtis and Elaine Wilson, with intellectual disabilities, who had been going back and forth from the community back into the state hospital well over 12 times. And each time they came back to the hospital, the primary treating physician, the psychologist, the social worker were all of the mindset that these two individuals could live within their communities. And so then they would send them back to their respective communities, and then there would be some issues that would come up, and then put them back into the hospital. So this went on for a good 12-plus times. So there was an attorney by the name of Sue Jameson with the Atlanta Legal Aid Society, who was at the hospital and heard from the social worker that you need to talk to these two women. So she did. And within the first hour of that interview, they both said, we just want to go home. We just want to be in the community. And so she filed a class action lawsuit against the state of Georgia, and the commissioner at that time was Tommy Olmstead. And so obviously, being the commissioner, the lawsuit was against him. And they made the argument that the cost for community-based care is far less than what we are currently expending in the state hospital. And for whatever reason, the state of Georgia disagreed with that. And so the defendants were able to make that argument through a lot of research. So they won at the Superior Court level, just to keep it very simple. They appealed, and the state of Georgia went out and gathered 22 other states to join them in this appeal going to the Supreme Court. Well, then the advocates found out about that, and they went to those respective states and talked to them, and many of those states backed out. So by the time they got to oral arguments and they were going to make a decision, there was only a small handful of states that were with the state of Georgia. So the ruling, the court held that public entities must provide community-based services to persons with disabilities when such services are appropriate, the affected persons do not oppose community-based treatment, and community-based services can be reasonably accommodated, taking into account the resources available to the public entity and the needs of others who are receiving disability services from that entity. So those two women now are in their back to their communities, and they have not come back to the state hospital. Two women with intellectual and developmental disabilities, And so they have those support services at a cost that's much less than what they were expending for them to be in the state hospital. This Olmstead decision is pretty historic. And so this resulted in a lot of the states doing more to shift from institutional care to where now most states, all states, have a 1915C waiver or some other kind of authority, but supporting people in their communities. And so this decision plays a key role. So this is the slide that we put together, and I think it was Senator Muchicki was the chair to this committee a couple years ago, where we were asked to address optional services in our presentation. So we did this, and it had an impact on the committee at that time. But if you look at this, at the very top horizontal box, the vertical column that lists the four waivers will give you the numbers that people serve. The column next to that will list the average amount that we spend per person on that waiver. And then to the far right, you will see for each waiver what the total amount is, and it comes to $278 million. In the middle horizontal column is our current institutional placements. We have 16 nursing homes, at least that I can remember, 16, and we served in FY17 840 individuals for an average amount of $164,000. So for SDS, we do those authorizations for nursing homes. It came to $137 million or $138 million. We do not have intermediate care facilities for individuals with developmental disabilities in this state. We used to have an institution in Valdez, but it was an agreement among the providers, the trusts working with the department. We got rid of that institution in Valdez. That was very significant. We shut down all of our ICF IDDs, and we took all those individuals and integrated into our community. And so we have 15 individuals currently that have very challenging behaviors. They're diagnosed with a developmental disability, but they have behavioral challenges on top of that. So they're currently out of state in ICF IDDs in Idaho. I've been very clear with the advocates that we should do our due diligence to try to bring them back, because if you look at the costs on that continual waiver slide, it's over $200,000 to have them in institutions in the lower 48. I believe, and I know the advocates will say the same thing, that there is a place for anybody in the community if you have the right kind of services around them. So if we were to just eliminate optional services, if you do the math, we would need then to, because mandatory service is either nursing home or ICF IDDs, we would grow the budget, not saying that everybody would go to an institution, but worst case scenario, there are the figures. So $506 million for nursing homes, not to mention that we have to build more nursing homes. And then ICF IDDs, we don't have those in Alaska, so the providers would have to turn around and build that. So that's just the cost of service delivery, payment for the service in these institutions, but doesn't factor in the cost for the infrastructure to build that. So I do this just to provide that as a foundation. So when decisions are being made about whether or not we're going to have optional services, I think this helps to understand the impact.
And I just want to clarify, when you're talking about optional, we're talking about optional waiver services, not. I just wanted to make that distinction between the Medicaid optional services.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, thank you. Senator Muchicki.
So my understanding is that institutional care is more expensive in Alaska than anywhere else. Where would you, if it's $201,000 per person in Idaho, if they needed to be institutionalized, how could you reduce the price in Alaska if they were brought home?
Through the chair, Senator Muchicki, we would bring them home into a community-based setting. We would not want to bring them back into institutions. We believe that those 15 can be served in a community-based setting. And the guardians and those that are responsible for them want that. So if we can bring them back, the challenge is the providers not having that capacity. So I've reached out to the providers, and we're going to work on developing some strategies to create support services for those individuals. So they would not come back to institutions. I would imagine the price of $200,000 and change in Idaho would be much higher here in Alaska.
And, Director, and I'm just trying to understand some of the increase of the spending cost here. In FY16, there's a Medicaid optional spending by category, by fund source, and you're able to break out sort of each fund of the other previous slides you had of each individual services and the waiver services by fund, federal spending and state spending. And FY16 was about $20 million less. Do you know where the increase of the four waiver services or particular services may be due to? I was trying to find that in the budget. It just says it was just underfunded, but doesn't say which areas were underfunded in the 2017 budget.
Mr. Chair, if I understood your question, the increase specific to the waivers, we have four waivers. We didn't see increases to three of the four waivers. We did see some increases to the IDD waiver.
And that's the area that you're looking to add, the sort of the fifth category to help offset some of that, I guess, the wait list or the...
So, Mr. Chair, we are adding that fifth waiver, and then, as I mentioned, we're putting a cap in place and a wait list. We were drawing, so when, as a division director, seeing costs going up with the IDD waiver, I reached out to the providers, and they know that we value this, but I've said to them that we need to kind of step back from the landscape of this particular waiver and recalibrate. And so I have been working very closely with them. So one of the ways to try to manage that is to reduce the number drawn. So there was a time where we were drawing 200. So about 2 years ago, we reduced the draw to 50. So that's just one way of trying to manage that. And then the other, and whether the advocacy groups agree with us or not, is our ability to look at certain service categories within that particular waiver where we're seeing some significant growth and capping it and making the argument that you need to provide documentation to us that they are, if they are at risk of institutionalization, then they can ask for additional hours. But this is the piece where we're trying to, you know, in terms of accountability, make sure that we're getting what they need and nothing beyond that.
Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff.
Yes. So just curious, you were here earlier presenting about autism, and I think that was last week. So the question remains, is that the category you're talking about with the intellectual developmental disabilities? I believe that this is a whole new category and service programs that we're going to be offering. Is that correct, starting as soon as these regulations are written here shortly?
Through the chair, Senator Imhoff, I'll let John respond to that. I think you were probably thinking of Randall Burns, who's the director for behavioral health. And so I'll have John respond to that.
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, again, this is John Sherwood. You're correct. People with autism do qualify for the waivered services under the IDD waiver. But the services that have been talked about for autism are federally mandated services under the early periodic screening, diagnosis, and treatment provisions of Medicaid or EPSDT, and they are going to be offered under the behavioral health budget of Medicaid. So they are in those regulations are in process. They've been adopted. They're at the Department of Law for review right now, and after they are filed with the Lieutenant Governor and become effective, then we'll begin offering those services. It's applied behavioral analysis for children with autism, it's not linked directly to the waiver.
Okay.
Follow-up, Senator Von Imhoff.
Okay, so it's not linked directly to the waiver, but it, I do believe, from, thank you for that explanation, I think it is going to add costs to the budget. Correct me if I'm wrong, families can qualify regardless of their income level, is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, there is, for most categories in which children, and EPSDT only applies to children through age 20, would qualify for Medicaid, there is there are income limits. The top limit would be, I believe it's 203% of the federal poverty level with a 5% disregard, so effectively 208% of the federal poverty level. There is one category for children who essentially meet the criteria of a waiver, but do not necessarily need the specialized services that are available through a waiver. It's referred to the TEFRA category for the budget bill that it was included in many years ago. And in that circumstance, the child does have to meet an income determination, but their parents' income and assets are disregarded. They must be determined disabled under the Social Security standard, and they must be determined to meet an institutional level of care. So there are some children who are on our Medicaid program under that category. And some of them do have a diagnosis of autism. It's not the only situation in which they qualify. But there are some children who really, since those children are not typically in a position to earn income on their own, would qualify without regard to their parental income. And just by way of background, the reason you have that category is because under the rules of the Social Security Administration, a child can qualify for a cash assistance payment if they meet those standards and they're living in an institution, and that cash assistance, the Supplemental Security Income Program, automatically qualifies them for Medicaid. It's one of the federal mandatory groups. So parents were faced with a choice of being able to get care for their children if they placed their child in an institution. But if they took their children out of the institution, then the parents' income would make them ineligible for those services. And so that option was added under the Reagan administration, very early in the Reagan administration, after a particular case was brought to President Reagan's attention. And so we have that category to avoid those kind of perverse consequences of how well-intentioned programs work. So,
please continue.
For the record, again, this is Dwayne Mays, Director for Senior Disability Services. We thought we would add two slides to kind of give you some information on what's happening at the national level. So I was able to, through the National Associations on States United on Aging and Disabilities, pull up a report from 2014 in which it stated that 3.2 million people currently are receiving home and community-based services throughout the country. That number obviously has probably grown since it's been a couple of years. The total, at that time, the total Medicaid spend for home and community-based services was about $58 billion. And again, that probably has gone up. I know that HBS Medicaid waiver services now exist in all 50 states. I did check and confirm that every state does have a 1915C. I think there's one state that has one. We have four, soon to be five, total of five. There are states that will have anywhere from 20 to 30 1915C waivers. And if you remember from the previous point that I made, you target your population. So we have four waivers specific to certain populations. And so what are they saying? And it, you know, I mentioned the Olmstead decision and the shift. So I read a report not too long ago where you can actually look at each state and see the shift from institutional costs at a very high end starting to drop, and there now is a shift well over the 50% mark where most states are now providing that. And why are they doing it? And so in this research, number one is it is a significant cost savings, and we've been talking about that in this presentation. Number two is the Olmstead decision. They want to avoid any kind of lawsuit. Number three, it's very person-centered, and you heard me say the two women wanted to go home, and obviously at a cost that's far less than what it was costing them at the, in the hospital. So very person-centered. And we know that we're a baby boomer society now. We have a flood of folks like myself that are aging, and so it's the state's willingness and readiness to prepare by having these type of programs for baby boomers. So those were the sound bullets that we got from at the national level.
Senator Pagich.
Thank you. Director, are you guys, or maybe this is for the Deputy Commissioner, I don't know, but are you projecting then, given our aging population here in Alaska, are you projecting how you see those populations changing over time based on your past experience? And do we have you done any of those projections?
So through the chair, Senator Pagich, yes, we have. We have the Commission on Aging as a beneficiary board advocating for our senior population, looking at what our priorities are, and then tracking numbers. And so I don't have that in front of me, but it's definitely, I think we will be in the next couple of years up to about 130,000 people in this state over the age of 65. So it is of concern to me as a division director when you look at the grants, and I mentioned to you that we've been flat funded for a few years now. We have our waivers, and we have the one particular to addressing our senior population. We have personal care attended option that also supports our senior population. In my presentation the other day, I talked about what's next, and I think we should always be focusing on low-cost, no-cost solutions. So I think the family caregiver model that some states have implemented and showed cost savings around reducing placement into nursing homes by extending a senior's time at home by 5 to 10 years. So there are some models that I'm aware of, and so I think in the next year or two, that would be one area where I would want to really shore that up and maybe replicate some of these models that occur in the in other states. They have demonstrated evidence-based, demonstrated success, so why not capture that? Drive down our nursing home costs is one. I think we should be much more aggressive with the existing nursing homes. I went to the state of Oregon, and I met with my counterpart there, and I asked him, what's the one thing when you're all done with this job and you look back, what's the one thing that you're going to be the most proudest of? And he told me that they really shored up their ability to have staff going into these nursing homes to identify who wants to leave and who wants to get back into the community. And he said as a result of that, they've been able to reduce their costs by millions of dollars. So he said to me point blank, that's a thing, Duane, that if anything happens over the next couple of years, is address that issue. So that's one of our priorities. Keeping a finger on the pulse of what's happening elsewhere can help us to generate ideas going forward. We're going to explode with our senior population, so national family caregiver, transitioning people out of nursing homes. I think those are two big pieces going forward for our division.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
So we thought we would throw this in, and this was a study that was done back in 2012 on the 1915 C waiver provided by the 33 states that have federally recognized tribes that are federally recognized tribes. They call them reservation states, and this study found that the state waivers mainly covered four categories of services, four populations. And we, for the most part, we address that. Developmental disabilities, we have that in terms of the IDD waiver and this new one that's going to come up in May. The elderly and disabled, we have that through our Alaskans Living Independently. medically fragile. We cover that in a couple waivers. You know, we have children with complex medical conditions who are very fragile. So it would be fair to say we do some of that. And then the brain injury, although there will be those that argue we should have a very specific waiver for brain injury, we cover that because of cognitive deficits within our IDD waiver. So we thought we would just provide the snapshot of that. And this is the last slide to just give you a list of what are all the authorities. You'll see the 1950C in the middle of the page. We are going to move forward with implementing the 1915K under Senate Bill 74. We'll go live with that in May. And so that's an option that other states have done to bring in more federal dollars into their states. There's an additional enhanced match from the federal government. We looked at the 1915I, but as a part of SB 74, we concluded that we would not be able to control costs. So with our contractor in the state saying no to that, that was something that SB 74 directed us to do, so we decided not to do that because we could not come back to you and say they were going to be able to control costs. So we looked at some of these authorities over the years, but this is just for you to understand what that looks like within the Social Security Act.
Senator Begich.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So this brings up the question, since we're looking at, obviously, you know, the incredible partnership with the federal government. Based on some of the actions the federal government took this past year and may be taking in future years, how are you preparing for potentially a loss of some of this federal money? You know, maybe through changes to the Affordable Care Act and or maybe through changes to funding priorities, those kinds of things. What are we doing here to prepare for those possible eventualities?
So through the chair, Senator Begich, I'll start this and then John will probably jump in as well. I get that asked all the time from the community. You know, we're looking at, with the Senate Bill 74 reform efforts, the ISW coming on board in May, the Individualized Supports Waiver, another 1915C waiver. The 1915K is referred to as Community First Choice, where we get an additional 6% match. There's been, in some of these proposals from at the federal level, that this option will go away or they'll drop the match down to 50-50. And so the community will ask me, well, so Duane, what's Plan B? What's Plan B? And I thought I needed to come up with something very profound. And I just said, Plan B is what we have right now. And let's just work on being extremely accountable with what we have and provide assurances that we're stretching our dollars to serve as many people as possible. So that's my answer.
That's an answer.
Okay. Thank you.
Questions? Well, thank you for presenting. I do have a question, and I appreciate the department coming forth and to give us presentation to show the, you know, the value of some of our Medicaid waiver services, optional waiver services. And in the presentation, something sort of struck about sort of the department's ability to expand regulations and expand sort of a coverage of Medicaid through regulations. How do you propose us as the appropriate, you know, legislature as appropriating body to help control costs when the department can just go through regulation to expand services and trying to look at ways that we can keep the Medicaid, because obviously we're going to pay our bills through Medicaid, and that's the option. The supplemental budgets come through, and this year's supplemental budget was quite a sticker shock for a lot of folks, and so how do we control some of those costs in terms of expanding services without being able to do that as the appropriating body?
Mr. Chair, again, this is John Sherwood. I think first I would want to make sure I gave credit to Director Mays, because when you look at the supplemental, the portion of the Medicaid budget that is not driving the supplemental is senior and disability services. We have done quite an impressive job. In most states, this is one of the most expensive parts of the program. certainly based on the number of people who receive benefits, it is probably, you know, per capita the most expensive population to serve, and we're able to manage those. The kinds of opportunities with regard to the waivers and nursing home transition and family caregivers are really intended to look at more cost-effective ways to provide to serve the same people. So I think you know, we do work very hard at trying to manage the cost of health care. Obviously, the Alaska Medicaid program is not the only health care payer who is challenged by that. It's I think fair to say it's universal, at least in this country, the challenges in trying to contain those costs. Continuing to have these discussions about what we are doing, what our intentions are, and where we're moving forward. Again, all the regulations we do are constrained by both federal law and by state statute. And I think, you know, having worked in the Medicaid program in Alaska for 28 years now, we really give full deference to state statutes with regard to what our obligation is in the program. You know, ultimately, I think with you want the department to have some flexibility in regulation to make adjustments, make changes, figure out better ways of doing things without having to come back to you every time and asking permission. I would say among Medicaid statutes, Alaska's statute is relatively proscriptive. Some state Medicaid statutes are more permissive. Our statute, the legislature determines which options we can take at the statutory level, both in eligibility and in the services we provide. But again, I think a big piece of it is just keeping the communication lines open about what we are doing and make sure we all understand where the program is moving forward.
Thank you. And I wasn't trying to reference just the waiver services. This mm-hmm. was something that sort of struck out as a sort of ominous issue. Any other questions from committee members? Senator Begich?
I'd just like to thank you guys for the presentation. Learned more about Medicaid today than I thought I'd ever know, so thank you both for that.
Oh.
Medicaid waivers, I should say.
All right. Well, thank you again, Director Mays and Commissioner Sherwood. Okay. Are there any other closing comments from committee members today? Seeing none, that concludes our business for this afternoon. On Monday, February 19th, we'll take up Senate Bill 124 by Senator Geisel, and we are adjourned at 2:49 p.m.